This is a WATD Political Forum on 95.9 WATD, online at 95.9WATD.com. Now, live from Studio B, here's your moderator, WATD's Christine James.
Well, good evening. Welcome to a WATD Political Forum. I'm your moderator, Christine James, along with reporter Tom Gorman from WATD and Duxbury Clipper editor Matthew Nadler asking questions. This primary election race is for the Republican spot for the 6th Plymouth District. Both candidates are here in studio tonight. We've got Jane Cornyn and Ken Sweezy, both vying to be on the ballot for the general election this fall. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
We're joined by our media partner, Local Scene, PAC TV. Thanks, folks, for being here. And timing us all is our own Charlie Fulmer. Now, the format is simple. We've asked the candidates to have prepared opening and closing statements ready, no longer than 2 minutes open and 1 minute close, please. Then we have a round of questions from the reporters and a lightning round where the answers are either yes or no or two sentences tops. Now, in our regular question portion, we ask the people to stick to about a minute. And if you consistently go over, ramble, or start to repeat yourself, then you get the bell. Now, like I said, we have Charlie timing us, and that's with that lovely construction paper there. Green means go, yellow means you have 10 seconds, and red means stop. If you're still talking when the red comes up, you get the 5-second grace countdown. If you're still talking, you get the bell, and if you're still talking after that, we cut your mic. So that's how we do that. Now, we just chose the opening and closing order out of the official WATD stand-in newsroom koozie. As we told you last election season, the real one got taken by maybe an angry person, we're not sure. So that's why I have a paper cup now. It will be Ken Sweezy first, then Jane Cornyn, and then we reverse that order at the end. So good evening, everyone, and let's start now with opening statements. Ken Sweezy.
Yeah, thank you, Christine. Thank you to all our hosts, WATD and Local Scene, for having us. I think we all know how important election season this is this year, so I appreciate the opportunity for us to talk about the issues. As mentioned, my name is Ken Sweezy, running for the 6th Plymouth again. I was the nominee back in 2022. I'm a local guy, grew up in the district in Hanson, had been there a long time. Family has a small business also over in Whitman, Massachusetts, Sweezy Fence. Grew up working there and digging holes in the heat of the summer rather than knocking doors like I am now. But after high school, went on to Loyola University Chicago, where I got my degree in forensic science, as well as an opportunity to sort of grow my faith and experience a liberal arts education away from home for once. From there, started my career in law enforcement. I was a civilian fingerprint expert for 4 years in St. Louis. Great city, but one of the most dangerous. We were very busy and saw a lot of things in a lot of ways that some of our systems could improve. So when COVID rolled around, I decided to move on back to Massachusetts. I got involved in local government. I was a volunteer on the capital improvements and economic development committees for the town of Hanson. Great opportunity the last few years to be involved in municipal government. Learned a lot and learned really where the state needed to step up. Recently moved over to Pembroke, so I had to forfeit those, unfortunately. But as mentioned, ran in 22 against a longtime incumbent, put up a really good race. One of the only candidates, if not the only candidate in his 10-year tenure, to win some towns against him. Took Hanson and Halifax, which was a great honor. So back again with the open seat. It's going to be a really good race. Excited to see what issues we talk about tonight. So thank you, everyone, again for listening.
Thank you again. That was the opening statement from Ken Sweezy. Now we'll have our opening statement from Jane Cornyn.
Thank you so much, Christine, and everyone. And thank you to any of the voters that are listening right now. This is a great opportunity to reach out to everyone. There's a couple things. My name is Jane Cornyn. I'm wanted to go over a couple things that people might want to know about me. Number one, I'm an entrepreneur. I co-founded and I am the CEO of an award-winning publishing company. We celebrate the South Shore and all the businesses in the area. This has given me the opportunity to learn more about the trials and tribulations of being a business owner. My clients are anyone from a hair salon to a builder, so I learn about their business and what it takes and what their struggles are. Number two, I'm a mom of 3 great boys. I've raised them to be successful young men, and I want to give a shout out. My youngest son Griffin's birthday is today, so happy birthday, Griff. being a mom has allowed me to learn many thousand different lessons, but number one being the importance of education, the necessity to advocate for your family and your children, and just overall looking out for the future of Massachusetts so that my children will be able to afford to live here and to have a better life. And number three, I'm not a politician. I've never run before. But I have been speaking up on important issues for many years. I've started way back when speaking up against Common Core. I've been fighting a 40B battle with the town and with neighbors for 8 years now. So I have the courage to speak up and have difficult conversations when it's needed, and I believe that will help me tremendously.
Thank you very much. That was the opening statement from Jane Cornyn. Now, Matthew Nadler, editor of the Duxbury Clipper, your questions for our candidates.
Okay. For whoever goes first, let's talk about housing to begin with.
Let's start with Ken.
Okay. In Duxbury, and probably in some of the other towns in the district, there's been growing interest in creating new forms of housing besides the traditional single-family home on an acre lot. What specific steps would you take, if any, to encourage housing construction, particularly multifamily or affordable housing?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really good question. That's definitely on the mind of everybody right now. Definitely the word, there's a lot of interest, I think, is an interesting way to put it. You know, something that's really important about our towns is the character of the South Shore. I think everybody cares. You know, I'm a young person as well, just as much as my opponent's children are, want to stay where we grew up. And I think it's really important that we have the housing that we need to do so. A big problem with the state right now, and I think the responsibility of a state representative, is to make sure that we're not jamming things down the throats of the towns to their detriment. What I always talk about is I want to help families, help businesses, and help our towns. We can't have those three things in conflict with one another. So sure, it may be great for individuals to have lower cost housing, but we can't be forcing unfunded mandates upon our towns. Increased calls for service for police, fire, you know, increased burden on the schools. There's a lot of things that we can do, like adding ancillary housing that are already on existing single family lots for family members. That's a great example of a common sense way to solve it.
Well, good. You guys are really paying attention to this colored paper. I love that. Same question for Jane Cornyn.
I think Ken and I agree a lot about this. Housing and towns are not a one-size-fits-all. Hanson is very different from Duxbury, and I think some of the state mandates that have come down are not practical for some of these small towns. We need to make housing more affordable by having better jobs and increasing the economy that helps everybody afford a house. But the overriding pushing from the state, where Boston is exempt, Cape Cod is exempt, the western half of the state is exempt, it just doesn't seem like it's a fair way to do it. Now, each town should be able to use their home rule and come up with a plan to build their future the way they see fit.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to do, Tom, do you mind if I jump ahead of you? Because I had a question about housing, too, and I think this will fit in with this. A lot of times we use words like multifamily housing, affordable housing. What about sensible housing?
Mm-hmm.
Let me start with you, Jane. What do you think would be sensible housing for the South Shore?
Well, I mean, I'm a big believer in the law of supply and demand. If there is a demand, then there are enough home builders and there's enough land that these houses will be built, with or without the government forcing it. And I think that when the state tries the overreach, it creates, you know, zones within the town that are all of one thing, and then the rest of the town is okay. I just think that the town should have home rule and to be able to decide where the growth should go and how it should work. And you know, it's been that way since 1966 and for many, many years before that. So we'll do a good job and take care of the people.
That's great. Same question. What do you think, Ken Sweezy? What do you think would be sensible housing?
Yeah, absolutely. I love the framing there. I love it. The common sense needs to be brought into a lot of these dynamics, right? So sensible housing, common sense housing, like I was just mentioning, you know, there's a lot of restrictions on putting an in-law in your home for your elderly parents, right? I knock on doors all the time where it might be a single elderly person in a 5-bedroom house, right? That starts to not make a lot of sense to make sure that our children will be able to, or younger people in general, first-time homebuyers will be able to get into town. We're not forcing anyone out of their homes, but we want to make sure that if that person's children are in town and they want to build an in-law, that they have the opportunities to do so, right? So making sure it's mixed when it makes sense. Hanson's doing a great job, for example. They're putting in two mixed-use buildings right across from the train station. That's something the select board has put in their master plan. That's something that the town contributions said that they wanted. Some of these towns have, I wouldn't say a great need, but a little bit of a need for some more commercial zoning so that they could, not zoning as much as commercial opportunity. So for the tax base, we have a beautiful coffee shop going in at the train station now. It's just a great opportunity and depends on what the towns
Sorry,
want.
Sorry, I lost track there. You're off. Sorry. Tom Gorman, question for the candidates.
What do you feel are the biggest issues facing your district?
Let's start with Ken.
Great. 1 minute. That's easy. So no, kidding. So one of the biggest issues, of course, I think, is the budget connection to the migrant crisis, right? Even with some changes that the governor's made, I think the migrant crisis is on the top of everybody's mind. And to me, this is a math problem. It really is. $1 billion last year that was not originally allocated, that was done through supplementals, $1 billion that is allocated for next year, and they predict that it's going to continue to balloon even larger. And the way that that's connected to the budget is just unsustainable. We saw some emergency 9C cuts. Some of it was reinstated, but you had Hanson's, Duxbury's, and Pembroke's fire departments all initially losing grant money. That's just, or earmarks rather, through 9C. It's inexcusable that our towns are being left out in the cold, right? And I'm not here to blame anybody for wanting to come to America. It's the greatest place on earth. I don't blame people for that. But to say that Massachusetts has to foot the bill and we're the only state in the nation with a right to shelter law, all the other states have immigration problems too, and we have a lot of revisions and a lot of things that we need to look at very, very hard. So that's just one of the many.
Same question, Jane.
Yeah, again, I would agree that that's what people are concerned about, that when we're knocking on doors and talking to people, they see it as inherently unfair that the amount of money spent, the $1 billion, is just for the shelters. That doesn't include healthcare, education, and 1,000 other ways we help support them. And that will definitely hurt our towns in many, many ways. It hurt our children in school because class sizes get bigger. Teachers get stretched because they're trying to teach. And I sat down with one teacher that had 5 different languages that she was dubbed a English as a second language teacher, and she didn't even know the languages. So it is an impossible task, and we must change the law as soon as possible and try to figure out some way to help those people who are here, but help our citizens first.
You're listening to a WATD political forum. It's the race for the 6th Plymouth District, the Republican primary. If you're not sure what the 6th Plymouth District is, it's all precincts of Duxbury, precinct 4 in Marshfield, precincts 1, 2, 4, and 5 in Pembroke, precincts 2 and 3 in Hanson, and Halifax precinct 2. Is everybody totally confused mm-hmm. now? That's why I have to write it down, because it's hard to remember. I want to stick on that same topic about the migrant issues. Too little, too late. They call it a federal issue needing a local solution. Mm. But it seems like that's been put on the shoulders of local legislators, and it seems like, well, what are we going to do? Because it seems like there's not much movement in the federal government, and yet you wonder, if the local solution, meeting in the state legislature. I was just reading something in the Globe the other day, and I'm sure someone will immediately correct me if I'm wrong, about a couple of consultants that they've hired now to figure out how to handle this problem, to the tune of, what was it? How many millions of dollars? I'm sorry I don't have that in front of me, but I'm thinking, how is this going forward, how is this going to be resolved, or are we just going to keep throwing money at something and not have any end in sight? So I guess my question is, we talk about maybe we need to change that law. Is that realistic? What else can we do, Jane?
It's absolutely necessary, because again, you cannot fault a migrant for coming to Massachusetts. I would come to Massachusetts if I had my choice because of the right to shelter law. If you knew that there was a place waiting for you to stay, I would choose here. So that law is an attractor. All of our, again, we cannot have a generous welfare state and an open border at the same time. There are 8 billion people in the world, and there are only 7 million in Massachusetts. We can't do the math. It just doesn't work. So that law should be drastically changed. It was intended for families with children that were getting out of asylums, and the people who really need it that are citizens. And I know that there are people that are homeless now that are Massachusetts citizens that are not getting helped.
Same question, Ken. What do we do? How can we keep saying it's a federal problem? How do we? It seems like there's not much movement there.
Yeah. Yep. There's two parts to what your question is. One is we don't need consultants. Republicans have been offering solutions for a very, very long time. I intend to be one of them as well. You know, Senator Durant, and even it was bipartisan, Senator Vellis Northern Massachusetts as well. Residency requirement. They were the first ones to do this a year ago. You had Rep. Paul Frost also offer the same thing, to have residency requirements. 9-month stays, 6-month stays. Everything that people are trying to applaud the governor for, say she's finally doing something, Republican representatives have already done. So So we have the solutions. We're on the right side of this issue, and there's no question about it. Polling, residents we speak to, that's clear. The other half is, like I mentioned, we're the only state. 49 other states are getting by just fine without a right to shelter law. The amendment is absolutely necessary. I agree with the residency requirement. I agree with putting veterans first, which was another Republican recommendation that got shot down, and now the governor's trying to claim a victory for some of the overflow sites. So people are playing politics. They can try to blame it on the feds all they want, but it's pure politics.
And let me ask you both a quick 30-second follow-up question. You know, I know a lot of people say, well, I'm a compassionate conservative. What do you think that could be done right now to do something to change the situation? What could be done on the state level?
Absolute advocacy. I don't think that the state needs to write blank checks to help people, by no means. I mean, I'm a practicing Catholic. I give to every Sunday when I go. There's been most of the transportation and these people moving around has actually been by private or nonprofit charities. It's not been by states, even if they want to blame Texas and Florida. It's mostly been charities. So the churches have always, and communities have always, stepped up to help people that live amongst them. We don't need the state government to do it. The government should be out of this process.
Same 30-second follow-up question, Jane. What could you do, like, right now to do something?
Yeah, well, it is a problem because even the changes that the governor just made, I have good friends that work in shelters, and, you know, after the temporary shelters were 5 days, but if someone's come from Guatemala, what do they do after 5 days? So we are knee-deep in a problem. We will need charities and everyone else to pitch in, but we have to stop the attraction and stop the flow in, because right now the money is just ballooning because we're going to have these people for many, many years.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm going to go back to Matthew Nadler, editor of the Duxbury Clipper, question for our candidates.
Okay. as you both know, the governor just signed a $57 billion budget. But what I'm going to get to is the budget process here in Massachusetts is less than transparent. Yes. Let's put it that way. However, the Boston Globe reported recently, they've done some work on this, that frankly, Republican legislatures fare less well than their Democratic counterparts, in getting earmarks and money for their communities. Given that, how would you effectively advocate for the towns in the 6th Plymouth District to get them the funds for the projects that they need?
Let's start with Ken.
Yep. So 2 points there. One, to touch on the first part of your question. Absolutely, transparency is a massive problem. I think this is the biggest opportunity for bipartisanship up there. You have a lot of farther left people and a lot of the Republicans that are interested in working together to, say, apply open meeting law to committee meetings. It's a shame that those votes are private. We have the least transparent state house in the nation. 100% has to change. I can promise that I would be offering up legislation every single session for that. That's quickly number one. As far as people who claim that, you know, in the super minority, Republicans can't get things done, I would say that's just just patently not true. What's a huge advantage of being in the supermajority that people don't recognize, Republicans serve on quite a few extra committees, actually. So your Republican representatives actually have a say and have their ear to the ground on probably 2, 3, 4 times as many committees as their Democratic counterparts. So just because we aren't playing ball, if you will, or in the same party as the speaker, does not mean we don't get our earmarks. I look forward to bringing consensus without compromising my values. But you have to have consensus and work together up there.
Oh, I almost got to ring this. I will get to that. Same question to Jane.
Yeah, I think really our job is to work with the constituents and to understand the needs. And as long as we are representing what is needed in the communities and on the different committees, and voicing and speaking up and speaking out about issues that are not fair, the money should be allocated. I will stand up for money and ask for it without any problem whatsoever.
Okay. I'm going to go to Tom Gorman now from WATD. Questions for the candidates.
This is actually a question from one of our listeners. Do you believe there is global warming in affecting the rising sea levels, and if so, how would you fix it? How would you address it?
Let's start with Jane.
Yes, I believe there are issues with global warming and that affect our seawall and our coastal towns. I think the agnostic of the cause, it doesn't make any difference. We have to protect our communities and to find ways to battle it. So one of the things that's happening in Marshfield is the Atlantic Resiliency Institute, I guess it's called, that's new, but that is a brilliant public-private partnership where you have scholarly input from Northeastern University and you have industry that's coming up with innovative ways to protect us. And I think, you know, we have to use every tool in the toolbox to work on it.
Okay, same question to Ken.
Yeah, great. No, absolutely. Coastal resiliency is one of the biggest issues facing our coastal communities, which obviously Duxbury and Marshfield are hugely connected to. So we have to support them in their beach nourishment programs, in their seawall reconstruction. And a big problem as well, don't forget that now the state is threatening to take away some of these grants with MBTA zoning punishments. So that's a huge place here too. So if you want to claim to be, you know, if the majority is trying to claim to be the climate friendly party and then they're going to punish towns when they're trying to actually help coastal resiliency, that's a big problem. So I'm going to make sure that we try to reel in that hypocrisy a little bit while we support our coastlines. And it's 100% something that no town can shoulder the brunt of this by themselves. Obviously, those most coastal communities protect our inland communities as well. You know, Duxbury Beach, great example. Even if you're not on the beach there, if you're on the bayside of town, that's still, you know, you're very interested in making sure those beaches are nourished. So all of those programs are very, very important. And the state has to have a solution, because when towns are trying to worry about police, fire, and education, and then they get dropped with, you know, multi-million dollar seawall problems, the state needs to step in to help.
Okay. I'm going to go back to that question about transparency in government and go to question one on the ballot question, the state auditor's authority to audit the legislature. Question one on the statewide election ballot, a vote yes would allow the state auditor, Diana DeSaglio, to audit all the departments, offices, commissions, institutions, and activities of the state legislature. How are you going to vote on that issue, Ken?
It's common sense. It's really common sense. Like I mentioned, we have the least transparent, least accountable state house in the entire nation. You know, a building that was closed longer than any other state capitol during the pandemic once it had passed. It's par for the course with the supermajority. It really is. And that's just part of everything that needs to change. Like I said, the closed committee meetings, all obviously, and I think it would be completely, it would baffle me why anyone would vote against this. She tried to do it, and I applaud the auditor for bringing this. She's a former colleague of theirs, and they don't treat her too nicely anymore. She's asked them to do it voluntarily, then she tried to sue them, and now they have to go to the ballot. And I think it's going to win overwhelmingly. I really hope it does. I will absolutely be voting for it. I encourage everybody else to. I think it's long past time, especially when, you know, we're talking about 58 plus billion dollar budgets. I think it's about time that the legislature is audited as closely and as often as possible. So I encourage the auditor's efforts, and I look forward to how everyone's going to vote on that.
What about you, Jane? What do you think about that? You think, are you going to vote yes to the state auditor can audit
legislature? Absolutely. Yeah, as a as a non-politician, learning that they are not already audited was pretty stunning to me. So I just, again, it's common sense. It is an absolute necessity for the rest of the taxpayers. We should know how our money's being spent, what goes into every single issue, and that's the only way to have faith in what our legislatures are doing. And again, I'm amazed that it's not already taking place, and I would vote yes readily.
You're listening to 95.9 FM Marshfield. I'm Christine James. It's a political forum, the 6th Plymouth District, and it's the Republican primary. We're going to take a quick break and be back right after this.
The Friends of Bridgewater Music Alley 2024 Summer Concert Series continues this Thursday with opening act Gordon's Love.
Vulnerable's not where I want to be.
And headlining the evening, it's R.J. McCarty.
Most wonderful of colors.
Music starts at 5:30 at Black Cat Brew Works in Bridgewater. The Friends of Bridgewater Music Alley is a nonprofit organization. For more information, visit bridgewatermusicalley.com.
Join us on Saturday, August 3rd for the Brockton Midsummer Music and Art Fest. Enjoy music, art, children's activities, and vendors from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at beautiful Salisbury Park on Crescent Street in Brockton. Bring a lawn chair or a blanket. Performances by local musicians LP Groove, Mother Funk, Area 508, and Gracie Grace and All the Good Boys. Brockton Midsummer Music and Art Fest, Saturday, August 3rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Brockton Salisbury Park. Hope to see you there.
New England Village invites you to their antique, classic car show and parade on Sunday, August 4th, starting at 11:30 at 664 School Street in Pembroke. Join them for a day of appreciation for vintage automobiles. The event is free and open to the public. Hot dogs, snacks, and cold drinks will be available for purchase. For more information, visit newenglandvillage.org. That's newenglandvillage.org. The antique and classic car show and parade at New England Village, Sunday, August 4th.
Hingham Civic Music Theater's thrilling production of Footloose, the Broadway hit famed for its youthful dancing, opens for 2 weekends, Friday and Saturday, August 2nd and 3rd at 7:30 p.m. The show at Hingham Town Hall's Sanborn Auditorium continues Saturday, August 10th, with a closing Sunday, August 11th, 2 p.m. matinee. Order tickets early at hcmt.org and get ready for Footloose.
WATD's political forum continues. Now, back to Studio B. Here's your moderator, Christine James.
That's right. We are back here in Studio B for the 6th Plymouth District Republican Primary Forum. I'm your moderator, Christine James, asking questions with me. We've got Matthew Nadler, the editor of the Duxbury Clipper. We've got Tom Gorman from WATD. And, of course, the candidates, Ken Sweezy, Jane Cornyn here, and with our media partner tonight, Local Scene PAC TV. Now, when we left off right before the break, it was time to go to you, Matthew. Questions okay. for the candidates.
Okay. The Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection recently ruled that Holtec, the owner of Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, can't dump 1 million gallons of treated wastewater into Cape Cod Bay. Do you agree with that decision? And more importantly, what do you think is the best option for disposing of that water, and what would you do to make it happen?
Jane?
Well, I agree with that decision. I can't say that I know how to dispose of nuclear waste. I haven't
worked in water, but yeah.
I think that would have been just a cataclysmic problem for our coastline. And I'm sure that there are ways to dispose of it that are environmentally sound and that, you know, have to be taken care of by the corporation. The state just has to put regulations and mandates on what they do, because we have to protect our number one resource here.
Okay. Same question?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this has been an issue that I've been very loud about the last 3 years from last campaign as well. Absolutely glad that we're going to be able to protect our bay. I'm a massive advocate for our fishing industry. It's probably the largest industry in the district. We have some very big businesses, relatively speaking, over in Duxbury and Marshfield, and support our local lobstermen and oystermen and all that. So to protect our bay is very, very important. I know they're investigating when you're talking specifically about Holtec. They're looking into if evaporation is a possibility to see if they might be able to evaporate some of it off. They're still doing some testing there. I think people are cautiously optimistic, if you will, that might be a better solution. You know, the most important thing is holding them accountable. I think that's a massive job for your local state representation, your state government in general. We need to make sure that our communities are protected from these large, you know, international businesses, conglomerates that want to affect our coastlines, affect our environment. So I will absolutely stand shoulder to shoulder with anybody, as I have the last couple of years on this.
Tom Gorman, question for the candidates.
What is your approach on balancing the historical preservation to the current needs of local communities?
Let's start with you, Ken.
Yeah, no, this is also sort of a passion project of mine. I'm very happy to be members of both all the Hanson Historical, Pembroke Historical, and Duxbury Rural and Historical Societies. They do amazing work. I've always sort of been a dweeb, if you will, on history, and getting involved locally is such a great thing. We live in such an awesome environment for our history, obviously, in Plymouth County. I'm a huge advocate for those organizations. They do very thankless jobs oftentimes, and when people want to develop or overdevelop, if you will, the towns, you know, those are usually the first line of defense, and I really appreciate the work that they do. So everyone who may be listening, thank you for all the work you do in that regard. But, you know, that's really important. We do have some resource land-wise. We do have other options, depending on what state law is going to do with zoning, to make sure that we meet our needs, whether it's new school buildings, whether it's more housing, whatever it may be. But, I mean, Pembroke Center is the perfect example of a perfectly preserved historical district, and they've done an amazing job there. So that organization in particular, but I certainly advocate to hold on to those organizations and what we hold dear in our local history.
Okay, same question, Jane.
Yeah, and I think this brings us back to the home rule, that the towns should be able to decide exactly where developments go and how they relate to the rest of the town and how they can preserve the character and the history, and that the government overreach influences that and hurts it. So I think we have to fight against that overreach so that the towns can preserve their character and to grow in a way that they've decided as their own town.
Speaking of development, I know the MBTA Community Zoning Act has been one of the most contentious issues that we have covered for a while. And one thing that I noticed, it seemed that a lot of people, whether they were officials or residents or even some of the major newspapers in the area, didn't seem to really understand what it was. And I remember people, a lot of fighting online about you're against affordable housing. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I never saw the word affordable written in the law. It was for density. So you, in theory, could have 15 $1 million condos on that acre. I think it was a little gift for developers that Charlie Baker signed before he left office. So other people are screaming about it's all about affordable housing. Not necessarily. So my question to you is, it's two-part. One, do you think the towns and the officials in the towns have done a good enough job of explaining to people exactly what it is that they're either advocating for or fighting against? Because I see a lot of questions out there and a lot of people that are confused. Jane.
Yeah, I think some of the select boards and town officials are between a rock and a hard place because of the threat from the administration to pull money. So obviously they want to be able to keep their budget strong and get as much money for the community, but then they want to protect their town. So it is difficult for them to come to a decision. Different towns have different opportunities on how to comply with the law without hurting it so much. But my worry is, just like the 40B law, once it gets down to the administration and years pass, then more and more and more encroachment of the town's rights and individual rights will be taken, because once we comply, say Duxbury just laid out a nice area where they can comply with the zoning, then later on they can come back and nab them. Sorry.
That's okay. I always tell people when you do your final, I was dying to use that bell, when you do your final wrap-up, you can always, if you felt you didn't get to say everything you wanted to say, you can add that into that. Same question for you, Ken.
Yeah,
what do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, this is, I'm very passionate about this because this is absolutely a perfect example of the slippery slope. They're asking for 750 units for most of our towns now, 1,500 in Marshfield. What are they going to be asking for next year? I think it's the state's responsibility to educate the towns. I, again, do not blame the selectmen at all. I think I went to every town meeting this spring. They did the best they could. They absolutely did the best they could. And I have no fault to the residents of why they were so upset, why there's been so much passion and vitriol around it. Again, we're talking about the character of our towns. Everyone wants their elderly parents to stay. Everyone wants their children to be able to live in the towns that they grew up in. We all want the same goal. I truly believe that. But to jam things down a town's throat, this isn't helping businesses, families, and towns. It's not what it's doing. Rather than coming and explaining it to us and saying, oh, this is a good thing because they've sued towns into oblivion. They've threatened them with taking money away. This is also another unfunded mandate. Again, schools, police, fire, all those calls are going up. All those needs are going up. So that grant money is not actually worth the price of the grant.
Well, I was going to ask you the quick follow-up for each of you for 30 seconds, and I'll start with you, Jane. Are you surprised with the quickness that the state came out with saying, we're going to sue you? And the state attorney general seemed just vehement about it. I was surprised by that. I was really surprised by that. Not that my opinion matters, but I'm asking for yours.
And the vitriol, I'm not surprised by much with the administration, but we have to consider that many of these towns are going from one home per acre to the MBTA Communities Act has a minimum of 15 units per acre. That is incredibly different, and it will absolutely change the makeup of the town. So I understand why people are against it, and I think the administration has overreached.
Okay, 30 seconds. What do you think? Were you surprised?
Least surprising thing I've ever seen. This is exactly what they did during COVID. This is exactly what they did. They don't explain. They don't assist. They're not there to help. Ronald Reagan, worst words in the English language, right? I'm from the government and I'm here to help. If that comes up, you better run. So nice little callback there for everybody. But no, I'm not surprised. I'm surprised it took them that long. They're going to continue to do this into the future. And that's why I think it's so important to have an advocate on Beacon Hill that's actually looking out for our towns.
Okay. Matthew Nadler, editor of the Duxbury Clipper.
Sure. Another question about the state budget. Included in the budget that was just signed, is money from the what's been called, as you certainly know, the millionaire's tax. Money from that is being used for making community college free for all people and also on providing free public transit on regional transit systems like GATRA. Regardless of your personal opinion of the surtax, do you think that's the best use of that money?
Ken.
Sure. Forgive me, I am just going to say that I don't like the surtax. not regardless, totally. But a big component there is we are losing those residents of the Commonwealth. And I'm not going to, say I'm any fan of the way or good or bad about the way millionaires spend their money. It's really none of my business. And personally, it's none of the state's business either. They are running these people out of town. We are taking a net loss in tax revenue from those people leaving. I believe it was $3.9 billion that had left last year from those high-income individuals. I mean, we're losing 1,100 people a week in this state. This millionaire's tax is not at all making up for what they've done to hurt the economy here in Massachusetts. So what that money should be used for, I mean, I think it's really hard to say that we should be giving more services when, again, we've just allocated $1 billion to the migrant situation. I think when they have emergency 9C cuts, maybe we can support our firemen and our policemen and our schools, rather than giving additional services like regional transit or free community college. There's a lot of worthwhile things. So I don't like towns or people fighting each other over it, but there's a lot of issues there. I'm right on, Christine.
It works, doesn't it? The red, the green, the yellow. Tom Gorman, questions for our candidates.
Just
thank you.
A little follow-up to that. You mentioned how many people...
I'm sorry.
See, I got ahead of myself.
I think usually when the government is offering to give something away free, it's not really working in its intended outcome. I just put three boys through college. We took out loans. We sacrifice. We didn't go on vacation. Whatever we needed to do, they, you know, they would never get the benefit of this. And I don't think that providing free community college is going to be the benefit to most of the individuals that live in our district. I also have run over and over again door knocking. When you hear people say, oh yeah, I would vote for you, but I changed my residency to Florida. Mm-hmm. So the millionaire's tax is another way. I use the phrase, we think you're stupid on the taxes, because millionaires and people with money can re-register and elsewhere and pay no tax.
Thank you. Tom Gorman.
Just to follow up on that a little bit, you mentioned a lot of people leaving the state. Why do you think that is, and how can that be reversed or at least tamped down?
Well, Jane. CNBC just rated Massachusetts with an F for business friendliness and the ability to grow a business here. That is unacceptable. We need to nourish small business and startup businesses. We need to nourish the middle class. The taxes are high, the regulations are burdensome, and people can, you know, the world is a more mobile place these days. So it makes sense that some people are choosing not to deal with the high taxes and high regulations and either start a business or retire elsewhere. We need to change that so we can hold on to growth and the wonderful people that are here.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons. The affordability is the biggest piece. The regulation, the overtaxing, it's all a piece, right? I mean, why would you live or be registered to live in Massachusetts when you can in South Carolina, Florida, Texas, Arizona? I don't blame anyone who wants to leave. Selfishly, I want, you know, Massachusetts natives to stay. Another big population we're losing is, you know, we're one of the most educated states, rated consistently. We have the best universities in the world. None of those young adults are staying either. That's a huge problem. We're draining one of our greatest resources there. Before, you know, now my job, I work tangentially in biotech. Boston, Cambridge is the best hub in the nation. That's going to go away when we understand that we have a place that's completely unaffordable for people to live and work. It doesn't make any sense. We could be in the twilight of, you know, being this great state, this model for the nation, being, you know, America's hometown area. I want to maintain a lot of this greatness, and I think that is possible. So we have to deregulate, we have to lower the taxes, we have to make it make sense for families, those just starting out or those that are on the back end that have done really well, to stay here.
I want to ask you about the new gun law that the governor just signed. What difference will the new gun bill make to law-abiding citizens, and what difference will it make to criminals?
Well, you just took the framing right out of my mouth. The first is going to affect a whole lot, and the latter, not at all. I mean, you consistently see law enforcement agencies coming out against this. You see the DA has come out against this. This law makes no sense. Massachusetts is one of the safest states in the nation. We have no, relatively speaking, there aren't these mass shooting, mass casualty events. You don't have people that have legally registered firearms committing crimes. As a quick frame of reference, when I worked in St. Louis for the police department, I handled about 200 plus homicides a year, just me, in an office of six people, never mind the whole department. Massachusetts had only 64 homicides last year. So you're talking about just a city of St. Louis of about a couple hundred thousand people to 7 million people in Massachusetts. I mean, we live in an incredibly safe place. I'm proud to be a gun owner. I'm very proud to be a member of Old Colony Sportsmen's Club. We have a long history of sportsmen in this area in our district. We have multiple clubs here. And what they're doing is a shame. I mean, people are mobilizing, and this is going to end up being taken up to the Supreme Court or well past the state. And I hope we get favorable rulings, because the legislature's out of control on guns.
Jane Cornyn, same question. What about
gun law? Yes, I am solidly pro-Second Amendment. I think this law penalizes law-abiding citizens, and it does nothing to stop a criminal at all. I know that there's a ballot initiative to try to get back on the ballot to reconsider it, because I've talked to three different retired policemen that they don't even know whether what they own is legal starting August 1st or not. And we can't have a law that is summarized in 10 pages. It's just too complex, and we do have the safest state in the union, second state safest. And we don't need to add more and more to take away rights that the government just doesn't have the power to take away. So we need to reconsider this law and to help those law-abiding gun owners.
Okay. Matthew Nadler,
Okay, I'm going to follow up on that question. I think you both mentioned that living in Massachusetts, we live in one of, if not the safest state as far as homicides, things like that are. But do you think it's possible that the state's already very strict gun laws are contribute to that that low homicide rate?
There's a lot of dynamics. If you look at the variables across different states, income is correlated to gun violence as well. Education level is correlated to gun violence as well. Overall wealth, overall quality of life, those sort of metrics. There's a lot of variables. I don't think it's fair to say, oh, because somebody who doesn't commit other crimes otherwise because they own, you know, a gun that's 2 inches longer, just as an example, you know, versus not, is contributing to safety. So, no, I don't think that the gun laws overall are contributing to, it's really just limiting access for those who are, you know, honest sportsmen. And I don't think you can point to that directly and say so. And I would just, with my couple seconds here, encourage everyone to go to the Gun Owners Action League website, goal.com. They're the ones that are spearheading the signature drive. So I really encourage you, if you're upset about that issue, to go check them out, find a place where they're collecting signatures, and make sure that we can get this thing reversed.
Jane, same question.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that we still do have crime. I have one son at Wentworth in Boston, and there's gunshots every night up there. So, you know, the criminals, the laws that are on the books, the criminals don't pay attention to. So adding more laws that law-abiding gun owners have to abide by is just kind of hypocritical. Again, when we have the most friendliness to illegal immigration and other things that are anti-law, I think that I think we ought to respect those people. I brought up my kids. They went through the junior rifleman group, and it's all about safety, and it's all about the ways to abide by the laws and to be a good citizen. And we have a lot of very, very good citizens that are gun owners.
Tom?
How do you feel about the current state aid formula? Some communities complain that it's not fair.
Jane?
Well, I'd be honest, I don't know a whole lot about that issue. I believe that we need to get a very transparent formula that will give the right aid in the on a number of different issues and make sure that everybody gets the town aid from the state. I'm worried about the state's budget, because no matter what the formula, if the state starts running out of money, the towns are going to be in dire need, and the state is reaching out to the federal government for more money. We are $35 trillion in debt, and that will all trickle down. So, you know, we've been flush with money for the past couple of years, and people have used that, some in very smart ways, some in not so smart ways, and I think the chickens are going to come home to roost over the next couple of years, and it's going to be a tight budget, and there's going to be a lot of cuts, and people are not going to be happy.
Tom?
Thanks, Tom. That's a great question. That is an issue I know about, because these formulas are not fair at all to our communities. You have, for example, the Duxbury schools are only getting $6 million in state funding, in Chapter 70 money next year. Other communities, even in our own district, are getting 12, 14, 16 plus million dollars. With these unemployment or wealth or income-based portions of the formula, this is literally redistributing wealth. This is taking taxes from the residents of our towns and giving them to other communities. And normally, when everything's doing well and the economy's doing well in a town, some of our towns that are doing better than others, that doesn't per se affect them as much. You could have a possibility where in the next 1 to 2 years, all five of the six Plymouth towns have to go to overrides. Those are happening already, and we're seeing some pass and some fail. Hanover's right next door just failed. They have some very tough decisions to make now and in the future. Hanson's going to have overrides. It's potential that Duxbury will next year, maybe the year after. All of these towns are going to be in very strict, tough financial decisions, and that is the fault of these state laws. So they need heavy revision.
Just want to ask you a question. Are either one of you worried about water and availability in your district, especially the latest budget that came out. I thought that the issue about the MWRA was going to come through. I know a lot of local towns was looking at it as a backup issue. We've always heard that's kind of the holy grail. If it never rained again, mm-hmm. there'd be enough water in the Quabbin Reservoir, you know, for the next 200 years. But it looks like right now that's not going to be a backup situation. You've got a very diverse district. Are you worried about water in that 6 Plymouth?
Yeah, 100%. I really wish we had more than a minute on this one. There's a lot with water that has to be addressed. One with the MWRA, I had been calling legislators in the State House to see what they meant, because originally the language was the South Shore, mm-hmm. and they really weren't looking to come down this far. So we need some... We do actually have a lot of water down here, a lot of surface water, but there's a lot of dynamics. You know, you have infrastructure failures. I mean, I know a lot of people listening to this in Pembroke have brown, rusty water quite a bit. PFAS contamination by far is going to be the most pressing issue. The EPA just came out with new regulations. I'm not sure how those are going to affect us or be enforced after Chevron failed at the Supreme Court. It's possible this won't be an issue. But from the data that we're currently collecting in our wells, if you applied EPA new standards, which I believe is 4 parts per billion is the technical amount, half of the wells in the 6 Plymouth would be closed. We cannot sustain that. We will run out of water. This is MEMA and FEMA levels of water access loss. So we need to get some quick solutions. We need to make sure that these regulations, if they go in place, we're not hamstrung.
Let's go to Jane Cornyn. Same question about the water. Are you worried about water in the district?
Yeah, and that is another one that when you're knocking on doors, you do hear, I don't really follow politics, but I don't like my brown water. and it's a tough thing to help people with. But we do have these wells. We have to keep them clean. We don't want any contaminants. Our water in Pembroke goes to Brockton. And then Brockton actually has the ability to sell the water from Pembroke while we use the well. So it's an old system. We want to make sure we keep everyone safe and that we keep the water clean. And there's a lot of work that has to be done.
Okay, we're going to go very quickly to our lightning round. This is when the answers are either yes or no, or one or two sentences, and then we'll go to closing statements. And this is, as a tradition, I always start this segment and ask you, this is a yes or no question. Plymouth County government, stay or go? Ken Sweezy.
After COVID, it stays.
Okay. Jane Cornyn, Plymouth County government, stay or go?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. You're going to like this one. Almost 900 people were arrested and convicted for their actions on January 6, 2021. The Republican presidential candidate, Donald Trump, has called those people hostages and promised to pardon them. Do you agree with him?
Yes or no?
Yes or no.
I'd like them to have a fair trial.
Yes or no?
They've been convicted, though.
Okay.
That's my
yes
point.
Or no? Jane Cornyn.
I believe there needs to be more... more insight into those individuals.
Again, that's, some a, need that's to be. A yes or no. Okay. Tom Gorm. Okay. Would you say or admit to watching less than 5 minutes or more than 5 minutes of the Karen Reed trial? More or less?
More.
Okay. Okay.
Thankfully less.
Okay. All right. What was the last book you read?
Profiles and Courage.
Okay, what was the last book you read?
I can't even remember. I'm a mom and a small business owner. I don't read books the past 5 years.
We're gonna go to closing statements here, and we're gonna reverse order. And this time, we're gonna begin with Jane Cornyn. You have a minute.
Well, I just wanted to thank you so much for this opportunity to talk to voters. It's really been wonderful. I want to remind voters that mail-in ballots are already out, and our primary is September 3rd. It's very important. I feel like I have a great background, a strong history with small businesses, and I've been a fighter for many years. So I would appreciate your vote. And janecornyn.com is my website. I'm here to answer any questions or sit down and talk to you about any issues.
Thank you very much. That was a closing statement with Jane Cornyn. Ken Sweezy, your final
Absolutely.
Statement.
Thank you so much to everyone at WATD, our host at Local Scene, my opponent as well. I think it's really important that we have these conversations early and often, so I appreciate this opportunity. I would just say, you know, it's about life experience between law enforcement, family, small business, municipal government. I have the tools and I have the relationships as well. People would agree. You know, I'm supported. I'm endorsed by Plymouth County DA Tim Cruz, the Massachusetts Police Association, the Mass Correction Correctional Officers Union, the Young Republicans, the College Republicans of UMass. I'm the only candidate in this race that's supported by select people from all five towns, as well as a plethora of school committee members, planning board members. I've created those relationships, and I'm ready to bring that experience in life and in politics after being the nominee in 22 and bring it to Beacon Hill and get things done for all of us.
Thank you. That was a closing statement with Ken Sweezy. You've been listening to a WATD political forum with our media partners here, Local Scene, PAC TV, and the two candidates, Ken Sweezy, Jane Cornyn, joining me, Duxbury Clipper editor Matthew Nadler. We got Tom Gorpin from WATD. Our own Charlie Fulmer is timing us. Larry Nelson engineering this tonight. This is going to be popped up online, put up online tomorrow. And of course, stay tuned to WATD for complete primary season coverage. And join us too on September 3rd, which is primary night. We'll be doing our political show right in the studio, bringing you all the results. Remember, get out and vote. If you don't vote, you don't have a voice. I'm Christine James, 95.9 WATD.